Support for Earth Eats comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com.
And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeigner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Kate Young.
A lot of these kind of foraged grains, a lot of them are very aggressively, tasting. They're very forceful. So a lot of good things to add to them are things that are smoky, sweet, and spicy. So things like bacon, for that smokiness, or a little bit of honey and a little bit of pepperoncini or the red pepper flakes are all really good in there. So fat, smoke, heat, and sweet.
We're going wild and free this week with a dish made from the stalks and spring leaves of the poke plant. You're gonna love what Chef D does with this potentially dangerous wild edible. Harvest Public Media has a story about difficulties in the dairy industry. And we revisit a conversation with clinical psychologist Katie Kopp Miller about how simple social interactions like grabbing a bite to eat with friends gets complicated for those in recovery from eating disorders. That's all coming up in the next half hour. Stay with us. Dairy farmers in Colorado, Kansas, Kentucky, and other states are feeling pressure from a market that is flooded with milk. Prices have plummeted amid supply from foreign producers and larger operations squeezing out small farmers. Reporting for Harvest Public Media, Nicole Irwin says the crisis has dairy farmers looking to other countries for solutions.
59-year-old dairy farmer Gary Rock sits in his milking parlor, overlooking what's left of his 95-cow operation in LaRue County, Kentucky.
300 years of history is something that a lot of people in our country cannot even talk about.
That's how long Rock says the farm has been in his family. While the land has turned out a number of crops over the years, since 1980, dairy has nourished the family in and out of tragedy.
In 2013, we had an F2 tornado that totally destroyed all the facilities here except the one we are sitting in, which is the milk parlor itself.
Rock says the community helped his family restore the farm. Weeks after it was rebuilt, another tragedy hit. Rock lost his legs in a tractor accident. Still, the dairy provided, this time more than an income.
It enabled me to find life again in a profession that I already knew.
Now the farm looks to weather its greatest storm yet, a disastrous drop in revenue.
To give you an illustration, the same farm on the same number of cows is selling $170,000 less of product.
This isn't a Rock family problem. This is a dairy problem. The milk market is saturated with supply. In February, major regional buyer Dean Foods started canceling contracts in 7 states. Another processor, Illinois-based Prairie Farms, will close a Western Kentucky plant in June.
It looks to be that this will be the last month and a half of milking that I do.
For months, the average price of milk has been about 30% below the cost of production. Things are so bad that dairy producers that do have contracts report that co-ops are attaching suicide prevention information with their checks.
Hello, Farm Aid. This is Joe. How can I help you?
Farm Aid Communication Director Jennifer Fahey says the tough times remind her of the 1980 farm crisis. With more than a 50% drop in net farm income across the board, Fahey says dairy is getting hit the hardest.
Sometimes the best case scenario is helping a farmer to navigate declaring bankruptcy.
The U.S. open milk market system is pushing milk production to larger farms. In 1987, half of all dairy cows were on farms with 80 or fewer cows, similar in size to Gary Rock's operation. By 2012, that midpoint herd size was 900. And international trade issues are magnifying problems. International Dairy Foods Association President Michael Dykes blames Canada for violating trade laws.
Now you have the Canadians coming in. They are selling skim milk powders, putting it on the ground in Mexico, 3 cents a pound cheaper than we can from the U.S. to Mexico.
Dykes hopes much of this will be corrected by renegotiating NAFTA or through U.S. reentry into the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But where Dykes sees Canada's system as a source of the problem, others see it as a possible solution.
I myself have, ever since I've been farming, supported some kind of supply management system like Canada has.
That's organic Wisconsin dairy farmer Jim Goodman. He's also president of the National Family Farm Coalition. In April, the NFFC joined family farmer, labor, and consumer groups in a letter urging Congress and the Agriculture Department to adopt a system like Canada's.
The government doesn't run it. They don't have to be worried about providing subsidies for producers when prices get low because of oversupply, because that doesn't happen.
At one time, the U.S. had 6 million dairy farms. Today, there are fewer than 40,000. Back in LaRue County, Rock says he likes Canada's limited quota-based system, but he doesn't know if the rest of America would feel the same.
We also want individuals to realize what is this picture that not only small dairymen are facing, but it's what we once knew as rural America, rural townships have faced, and that is trying to survive in an industry that is continually telling you, you have to become larger to survive.
For Harvest Public Media, I'm Nicole Irwin.
Nicole Irwin is part of the Ohio Valley Resource Public Media Collaborative and reported for Harvest Public Media. Harvest focuses on farm and food issues in collaboration with public media stations across the Midwest. For more information, go to harvestpublicmedia.org. We visited Chef Daniel Orr in the kitchens of Farm Bloomington Restaurant recently, and he was all excited about spring foraging. He'd been out in the woods scouting for garlic mustard, dandelion, wild onion, grape leaf, and poke. Now, I've always been warned not to eat poke. They have some mighty attractive purple berries in late summer, and they really look like something you could eat, but they are not. Chef has some news for us about what part of the poke plant you can eat, when it is safe to eat, and, more importantly, how to cook it.
A lot of these kind of forage grains, a lot of them are very aggressively, tasting. They're very forceful. So a lot of good things to add to them are things that are smoky, sweet, and spicy. So things like bacon, for that smokiness, or a little bit of honey and a little bit of pepperoncini or the red pepper flakes are all really good in there. So fat, smoke, heat, and sweet.
For this poke preparation, Chef is definitely going in the direction of heat, salt, and fat with some country ham, cracklins, chilies, and a whole lot of patience.
We're going to work with one of my favorite ingredients of spring, and that is poke. And it's something my grandparents ate, and it does take a little extra preparation. There are a couple of things you have to do to make it humanly edible. The first thing is you have to pick it early when it is 8 to 10 inches maximum in height. You don't want to have any purple veins on the leaves, just nice and green. The leaves are nice and spinach-like. They're super tender. And the stems have kind of a asparagus-like texture and flavor to them. So I like to cook them separately and then mix them back together. It is a perennial plant, which means it comes back every year. So once you find a poke patch, usually you can find it every year. You can go back to the same patch and harvest several times during the spring if you cut them off at the ground level, then they'll come back and you can keep harvesting until around June. This was one of the last commercially canned products that was a wild foraged product. And there was a company that canned it still up until the 1990s. I believe they stopped after that, but you used to be able to buy canned poke, but it was one of those old timey vegetables that my grandparents couldn't get enough of. All right, so I've picked off most of the leafy, spinachy part. Now I'm going to cut the stems And while we're doing this, I have some water on to boil. And the first step is to boil everything for 10 minutes. And then we're going to drain it and rinse it, and then repeat. And that second boiling brings out a lot of the vitamin A, which can be harmful to human beings if taken in a huge quantity. So that's one of the things you're pulling out of the plant as it cooks. The old timers call it poke salet, S-A-L-L-E-T. And salet is a old English term for a mess or a gathering. So a mess of greens, it's where this comes from. All right, so I've cut this in about 1.5-inch pieces. It's ready to go. I've got the leaves all taken off separately. They're ready to go in the water. And we'll be back after I blanch them twice.
So remember, he's blanching them twice and pouring out the liquid in between, not to remove some bitterness or a flavor you might not enjoy. This is to make sure you don't get sick from eating it. So definitely don't skip any of these steps when preparing poke. And I need to say, when it comes to foraging generally, do your homework or go out with an experienced wild edible hunter your first few times. Books can be helpful, but hands-on identification with an expert is the best way to learn. It's easy to misidentify plants, and it's especially easy to mistake a poisonous mushroom for an edible one. So have fun out there, as Ewell Gibbons would say, stalking the wild asparagus. Foraging for wild food is thrilling. But please, do be cautious and research what you eat before you eat it. Now let's get back to the kitchen to see what Chef Orr does with that poke once he's made it safe to eat.
So we're back with the poke greens. I've blanched them twice. They're in their second water. I'm going to drain them off. Okay, shake them out. And if you smell that, can you smell that kind of an asparagus almost?
Oh, it really does. That smells just like asparagus.
And it's wild and it's free. Okay, so I've got those draining. Now, another pan. This is going to be kind of my version of a real old-fashioned way to eat poke. So this is country ham, the true aged country ham. Very, very salty. Then these are the outside of the ham turned into cracklins, tomatoes, green onions, garlic, and then a little bit of jalapeno. So I'm going to put a little bit of oil in the pan to get it started. Add the jalapeno and the ham. Okay, and we want to get a little bit of caramelization on that ham. Caramelization is where you develop the sugars in a product and it turns brown. Now, once we've got that kind of rendering, I'm going to add the green onions, the garlic, tomatoes, and some of the cracklins. My house on Sundays when my grandma would cook for us, she usually meant fried chicken and greens. She would always serve what she called the pot liquor next to the greens. So the pot liquor was the juice that came out of the greens, and she would add vinegar and butter, salt and pepper, and serve that in a pitcher. And then you'd have your greens and you'd drizzle your pot liquor over the top of your greens. And you remember how the poke looked like there was a whole lot of it, but once we blanched it and cooked it down, it only made about 3 cups of greens. A lot of times country cooks would cook this a long time now, a lot longer, maybe 15, 20 minutes, and really cook the heck out of them. But I like to leave the onions a little bit crunchy, the tomatoes still a little bit fresh, so you can really taste the different components of the dish instead of just having kind of one homogeneous flavor. Okay, I'm going to taste it for salt and pepper. Those stems are really good. Again, tastes a lot like asparagus. I'm gonna add a little more salt and pepper, and I'm gonna finish it with just a nub of butter. That's not in the recipe. But the butter, once you put the butter in a dish, you want to turn off the heat because you don't want the butter to break and get greasy. So when you add butter to a dish, you always just add it at the very end, remove it from the fire. In French, they call that embourré en beurre, which means enrobed in butter. And that is our slow-braised poke greens, poke salad, with tomatoes, green onions, and country ham.
We always post photos and recipes from everything we cook on our show. You can find that at eartheats.org. While you're there, look for links to resources like books on foraging, for instance. Again, that's eartheats.org. And don't forget to follow us on Twitter, at EarthEats. If you want to make sure you never miss an episode of Earth Eats, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. We love hearing about what you love and about what you don't love on our show. So leave us a review or send us an email, eartheats@gmail.com. Production support comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services, assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows, helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Up next, we have a 2017 segment from Earth Eats founder, former host, and producer, Annie Corrigan.
At some point in their lives, 20 million American women and 10 million American men will suffer from a clinically significant eating disorder. That could be anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, binge eating disorder, or OSFED, that's other specific feeding and eating disorders. Psychologist Katie Kopp-Miller specializes in working with people age 13 and older who are receiving treatment for or are in recovery from an eating disorder. Lee Bush and Maddie Chera of the Indiana University Food Institute have a professional interest in food, in restaurant culture, and in the community we make around food. Dr. Miller, today, offers a different way of looking at our 21st century world of food. First up, it's Maddie.
The concern about healthy behavior like eating and exercising is so pervasive in our culture, and it's, you know, in general, makes sense. It's a good thing. How does one know whether they're within the bounds of like a healthy attitude towards those things?
Especially since all women have concerns about their bodies, it just seems to be pretty natural in our culture to think about our body image on a semi-regular basis.
Yes. And men too.
And men too.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So I think of body image on a continuum. Mm-hmm. So on the one end, you have body positivity, where you feel good about your body, you're confident, you own it. And then on the other end, you have body disparagement. And then in between, you have various grades of body dissatisfaction or negative body image. So in the U.S., it's common for women to have mild body dissatisfaction. It's brief, it's fleeting, maybe it comes up from time to time, but it doesn't ruin your day or doesn't really drive your day-to-day behaviors. for someone with an eating disorder, they're more on that body disparagement end of the continuum. So they feel repulsed by their body. They feel disgusted about their body. And it really drives behaviors. So it drives those restricting behaviors or over-exercising behaviors. And then in terms of the behaviors themselves with eating or exercising, really looking at the function and dysfunction of it. So is there a sense of well-being in that person's life? Are they able to function well at work or in relationships versus is this the center of their life? Is it actually dysfunctional? So with someone with an eating disorder, kind of food is everything because body shape and size is everything. And your ability to control your body shape and size is everything.
I sometimes wonder because food is the center of our world to some extent. Do you know or have you observed any difference between people that are just really into food and an overlap with eating disorders?
Yeah, that's a really good kind of distinction to point out. So with someone with an eating disorder, food is a means to have control over your shape and weight. And so with someone who's just really interested in food, the function or purpose of food is probably really different. Probably doesn't have as much to do with controlling your shape and weight. It might be more about, you know, pleasure or cooking or restaurants. And so that's the real difference, because the core pathology of an eating disorder is your over-evaluation of your body shape and weight. And so, again, placing your self-worth and your body shape and size, and then the over-evaluation of your sense of control over it. So people with eating disorders believe that they have much more control over their shape and size than they actually do. And food is just kind of a means of controlling that shape and size.
I'm kind of wondering what you think of the technologies that have come up relating to body weight management, because I feel like it's very socially acceptable these days for everyone, including my mother, to have a watch on that tells you exactly how much exercise you've gotten in a given day. And along with that, you can record your calories and you can compare all day long. And it's all over the media as sort of a healthy way to manage your eating life and exercise life. Do you have an opinion about this?
Oh, I do. You got Fitbits and MyFitnessPal. They are like the bane of my existence professionally. Just that, I mean, people with eating disorders really, those apps can really facilitate restricting and over-exercising and measuring. And so with someone with an eating disorder, it's hard for them to use that in an appropriate, reasonable, functional way. It's much more likely to be triggering and to be taken to this very obsessive, rigid, perfectionistic place. Now, there are other apps. There's the Rise Up app, which is for people in recovery. So it's a way to log your food that does not have anything to do with calories or amounts, and then it has kind of inspirational messages that are embedded in the app. So there can be positives, positive
really
uses
cool.
of technology.
Yeah. It seems like technology too is implicated in kind of a bit of a generation gap that might be part of the dynamic between parents and adolescents. We were talking earlier about the thigh gap phenomenon and how a lot of people in the older generation kind of miss some of these trends or things that are influencing young people in how they think about their bodies and their activities.
And you're right. I mean, you're speaking to, like, there's trends in bodies. So, like, the thigh gap, like, that's a trend.
Or what is the thigh gap exactly?
The thigh gap is where the thighs don't touch. So the person stands with their legs together and the thighs aren't touching.
Which is rare, is it not, for a woman?
Yes. So physiologically, the body's, you know, in the body, the thighs touch, unless you are bow-legged or there's something else going on physiologically. And if you're malnourished and very underweight, you might have a thigh gap. And so a lot of models or a lot of celebrities, you know, might post pictures that show a thigh gap. And so that kind of feeds into this, well, I should have a thigh gap. There's something wrong with me that I don't have a thigh gap, even though I actually, that's because a person is under eating and malnourished that they have a thigh gap.
Or photoshopped. Kind
exactly,
of.
Yeah. The other piece I've noticed is that you know, in the 90s, there was the heroin chic of being very, very thin and kind of gaunt. And now there's a movement toward women being strong, and strong is the new skinny. And that can also be just another version of an unattainable standard. So now it's not being thin. It's I have to be thin and sculpted and very muscular.
One thing we were wondering is, so, you know, we're focused on food here at Earth Eats and at the Indiana University Food Institute. And eating out and restaurant culture is oftentimes a big part of being both an adolescent, but especially as you start to live on your own. Is there any way that eating disorders sort of interact with that culture of eating out?
Yes, that's such a good question. So that is such a common piece of work with someone moving into recovery, that it's very difficult to spontaneously go out and get ice cream with friends or go grab dinner with friends, or if they don't know what restaurant it's going to be and what the menu is going to look like. So I'll often be working with people who will look up the menu ahead of time and kind of really figure out what they're going to eat. And there are some social situations where that's not possible, and that can feel very triggering and anxiety provoking, and that can lead the person to cancel on plans or to not make plans that are centered around food, which can lead to social withdrawal, because a huge part of socializing in our culture is around food. And so a piece of work in recovery is practicing that flexibility. So being able to walk into a restaurant, not know what's on the menu, and then order something and eat it. Or being able to go grab ice cream with friends. Because it really limits your participation in community when you're not able to do that.
Thanks so much, Katie.
Yeah, thank you so much, Katie.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Maddie Chera and Lee Bush of the IU Food Institute speaking with clinical psychologist Dr. Katie Kopp Miller. For more information on treatment for eating disorders, visit the National Eating Disorder Association website, which is nationaleatingdisorders.org.
Thanks to Annie Corrigan, Earth Eats founder and former host and producer. Also thanks to Maddie Chera and Lee Bush of the IU Food Institute. You can find links to resources on eating disorders on our website, eartheats.org.
Support comes from Need More Coffee Roasters, a woman-owned coffee bar and roastery dedicated to roasting organic, direct trade, and fair trade coffee from small-scale farmers around the world. Offering signature drinks, teas, and little eats. Located on Pete Ellis Drive, needmoreroasters.com. Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent with Personal Financial Services. Assisting businesses and individuals with tax preparation and planning for over 15 years. More at personalfinancialservices.net. And The Clean Bedroom, offering organic mattresses, adjustable beds, and pillows. Helping mindful customers create a sustainable and organic clean bedroom, step by step. New York City, Boston, and now Indianapolis. More at thecleanbedroom.com. That's it for our show this week, but before we go, I'd like to thank the people that make our show possible. That includes Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Alex Chambers, Mark Chilla, Taylor Killa, Daniel Orr, and all the good folks at Farm Bloomington Restaurant, the IU Food Institute, and Harvest Public Media. Special thanks this week to Annie Corrigan, Maddie Chera, Lee Bush, and Katie Kopp Miller. Earth Eats theme music is composed by Aaron Toby and performed by Aaron and Matt Toby. Our executive producer is John Bailey. I'm Kate Young, and I produce the show. Thanks for listening to Earth Eats, and we'll see you next week.